1, 2, 3, 4.
Thanks for listening to this podcast produced by Diddy TV. Visit DiddyTV.com for more exclusive on-demand content or download the official Diddy TV app from your app store today. Hey folks, welcome to Insights, where our guest this hour is American roots music pioneer Jesse Colin Young. From the countercultural and revolutionary era of the 1960s, leading the Youngbloods and making his mark with hits like Get Together, all the way into the 21st century with albums including Dreamers and Highway Troubadour, Jesse Colin Young has remained a wildly inspiring figure in music, a multifaceted American music icon. We're so glad to have Jesse Colin Young on the show today and to be able to share his conversation with Amy Wright with you right now. So let's get started. You're listening to Insights from Diddy TV.
First of all, I wanted to say happy birthday. You had a big birthday in the fall. How did you celebrate?
How did I celebrate? Well, we haven't seen our kids for 2 years. So at the beginning of November, there are three of us have birthdays in November. Me, I'm not no longer a kid, only in my mind. And my daughter and son, my godson, they're all in Northern California. And then Jazzy, whom you know from her work on Trouble and a wonderful EP that she released last year called Grown Up and Grown Apart, she drove up from LA. So we gathered in a little house on Tamales Bay, where that was my introduction in 1967 to California. And Youngbloods were living in New York at that time. And I just fell in love with Marin, the county just north of San Francisco. And, you know, we played the Avalon once and we all ran home and packed our stuff and moved.
The great migration west.
Yes, because, you know, in 1967, not many people know, Get Together was people who were there. It was a hit in the Bay Area and on the North Coast, maybe all the way to Seattle, but nowhere else in the country. But I mean, we walked and we had no idea. We came in, we played the Avalon. We're on the radio, really? And the audience loved us and we realized we needed to make our home there. So we moved. After, you know, 3 or 4 years on the Lower East Side, I'd been there twice that long because I was going to NYU. We were ready for the country, and it was so beautiful out there. So that's how the birthday was spent. We all celebrated all of our birthdays together.
Wow, it sounds like a great time. Anyone play any music? Did you whip out the guitar?
You know, we didn't. We didn't get around to that. That often happens. We had so much to talk about after having not seen each other for so long that, yes, the jawing went on late in the evening. It was wonderful. And we got to walk. I got to walk where my old house was on Tamales Bay, which is now a park. Thank God it's not a,
strip mall or something.
Yes. Because Marin, that part of Marin, because of all the parkland, has stayed incredibly just like it was when I lived there 30 years ago.
That's a miracle, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a miracle. It is a miracle. What a thrill that was for me to think, well, wow, this is one part is not spoiled yet and not going to be really. It was John Kennedy who went through there with our senator, state senator, Peter Baer, who lived up on the ridge right down the road from me. And John Kennedy said, have you... you know, from the top of our ridge to the ocean was just ranch land. And Kennedy said, have you seen what has happened to where is he? Where is Chappaquiddick and all that stuff? It's on Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. He's, have you seen what happened to Cape Cod? He said, that's going to happen right here. If you don't make a park out of this, you know, you're going to turn around and there'll be houses all the way to the ocean. And so Senator Baer worked on that for years. And finally, it became National Seashore. And now it is still, it's still there, just like it was when I arrived in 1967 and said, where is everybody? I went to the beach and there were two people. And one of them was 3/4 of a mile away. I was amazed and so beautiful.
It's incredible how much is accomplished by a handful of people that wanted to preserve the parkland in this country. Right. It's thank goodness for those people. Well, where did you grow up, Jesse?
I was born when I in Queens, New York. So I grew up in an apartment there. It was kind of neat because it was apartments all around a block, and a big block, and then the inside was grass. So we actually had a sledding hill, and lots of places to play stickball. My sister was she played with us. She was older. She was good.
So were you playing music, or were your parents, were they musicians, or did they encourage you to play?
My dad played piano. He was a classical pianist, but not a professional. But I mean, he was an accountant, but he would come home and unwind playing the piano. And then, of course, having been the first man in his family to go to college, he had to teach us all of the Harvard fight songs about how they kick Yale's ass. And so besides all the camp songs, and my mom had a beautiful voice, mezzo, soprano. I wonder if she was an alto. I don't know. Beautiful. And my sister and I both came on with the voice. Part of it was genetics, and part of it was, until it was 10, there was no TV in our house, and they resisted it. It was great for us because and there was no radio in my father's car because he was an accountant. He was being thrifty. And so we sang, and you know, and we were bored, we sang. And on a college trip, we sang. And on holidays, we sang. And got a lot of singing in there. And I made my debut at his Harvard reunion. What was it? Life Begins at 50 for the class of 25. They found out that I knew all the Harvard fight songs, so they put me up on a cocktail table. I think I was 8. And there was an accordionist there who made his living, you know, knowing all of the college. So he knew them all. And I had a little concert. And that was the beginning.
Did you start writing music when you were a kid, or was that much later?
I probably started when they sent me off to, I wanted to go to prep school. I had come out of a wonderful high school in Garden City, Long Island, and we had moved to Bucks County, Pennsylvania. My father moved jobs and was not as strong a school. So my dad suggested that I apply to, or maybe it was my uncle, suggested I apply to Andover. And I took the train into New York and did all the tests, and I got in. I had no idea what I was doing, but I got there as in the beginning of 11th grade and found that they were offering guitar as an elective. And I had played the piano for years, but never really connected with it because, well, I mean, as soon as rock and roll came on the radio, I didn't want to play whatever kind of
song. So where were you listening to the radio, though, if your dad didn't have one in the car? Were you sneaking around?
I was listening at home. We moved out of the apartment, and then I ended up with my own room and my own radio when I was 10. And guess who came on the air in that same year? Alan Freed. And then at the other end of the dial was Symphony Sid. So it was doo-wop from wall to wall. And I found that I could leave my radio on all night if I turned it way down. But it was in my head. It was in a little headboard thing. So it was really close to my ear. And I leave it on all night. So it was on for 3 or 4 years. And I was soaking up music while in dreamland, both awake and asleep.
So you started playing guitar while you were in boarding school. Did you like boarding school? Because that's a little bit, that's a lot different than going to a more traditional high school. Or did you like it?
Did I like it? No, I didn't like it. But it was really good for me. Because the workload was tremendous. And I just, you know, I went from an hour of homework a night in public school to 6 hours at Andover. I mean, going in the 11th grade is pretty tough. That's a tough year. So I learned, you know, I think I learned everything I needed to learn about work and my capacity for jumping into things that I didn't know about and being able to do it, learn how to do it. I credit Andover for my, when I wanted to build a recording studio, I had no idea how to either design the building or use the equipment. And I just said, I'm gonna do it. I'm tired of flying to LA to go to a studio. I'm gonna build one right here in this gully. And although the house burned down in 95 on the ridgetop in a forest fire, the studio down in the gully remained. The fire skipped over it. The fireman said, with all the 100-foot trees, that all the oxygen was being sucked out by them burning at the top where all the fuel was. And there was no oxygen down to burn up the studio. What a blessing. My godson lives there. Jazzy cut the tracks for Grown Up and Grown Apart, her first EP there on the ridgetop. So,
did you build another house after your house burned down?
No, I said, I can't do this again. We're supposed to get out of here. So we had a little place in Hawaii, very little. When we bought that little farm, it was just a getaway, and there were the two of us, Connie and I. And by 95, Jazzy was a year, and Tristan, our son, was four, so off we went to Hawaii for a new adventure, turning the boy from Queens into a farmer, which takes a lot of doing. Connie had always been her mother said, from the time she could sit or stoop, she was planting things and seeds and has always loved it. But I know nothing about farming, and I learned about it and loved it for a while.
Do you still own the farm in Hawaii?
We still own the farm, and sadly, we have just rust has been attacking the coffee farms all over Hawaii, and it finally has. We had to cut our orchard down. Not the tree trunks, but all the branches, anything with a leaf on it. of our crop. So there won't, it's been wonderful. I mean, it's been, we've had a crop since 1990. And so for the next 3 years, you know, hopefully we'll find a way to grow it back. Yeah, I mean, it will grow back, whether the rust will. It's been kind of the close the book on this. I don't know what I'm going to do when I run out of coffee. I'm so fond of ours.
Well, to go back a little ways, because we want to see how you got started with the Young Bloods, and and you had a massive hit Get Together that you probably didn't even anticipate having. So just, you get out of high school. Did you go to college?
I started, I got kicked out of Andover about 2 months before graduation. Broke my father's heart. But it was really where I needed to go, because I was thrown out for playing the guitar at the wrong time during study hours. That was a big flag for me. So I went out to Ohio State, because they had come to Andover and trying to get some boys for their accelerated program they were starting. So off I went and moved in behind a record store. And that's where I was meant to be. I couldn't afford all the records, but I had a tape recorder. And I wish I could remember his name, but he said, listen, there was no shrink wrap. Just take the record home. This is T-Bone Walker. This guy is really something. Take it home and play it once and tape it, and then bring it back. We just put it back in the rack, as long as you don't scratch. So there I was, discovering T-Bone Walker, B.B. King, Ray Charles,
the greats,
discovering the roots of what I had been hearing and what Elvis brought forward, because that's what he was listening to. I mean, it turns out that everyone was listening to T-Bone Walker. Chuck Berry was listening to T-Bone Walker. B.B. King was listening to T-Bone Walker, and his mother. Amazing.
What a great education.
Huh?
I said, what a great musical education to live right behind a record store.
Yes, and that's where I belonged, and that's really what I did mostly. I did that, and I went to my ROTC class and tried to learn how to polish my shoes properly for ROTC. That's because Ohio State's a land-grant college, and you have to do 2 years of ROTC. So I didn't get through 2 years. But I did tape a lot of records, and then I read Jack Kerouac's On the Road, and I had to take a trip and in the middle of winter. This was after one wasn't even a semester; they were quarters at Ohio State. My poor father. I said, Dad, I need to hitchhike. I lived in the suburbs all my life. I don't know anything about life. I want to find out. Crazy.
Well, that was such a turbulent times. These are changing, point in history. And you're kind of living through that. And maybe going from something that was more conservative to a society that was going to really change in the 60s. And what was that like for you? When did you actually form the Young Bloods as a band? Was it after Ohio State, or were you back in New York?
Yes, after Ohio State, I bought a Triumph motorcycle, and I had to spend a year working in a factory, living at home with my parents to get it fixed up enough to... because I think
drive across country in it.
Yes, to complete my on the road dream.
Right.
I mean, ever since I saw Marlon, in The Wild Ones, and which I probably saw 10 times as a child. I always wanted a triumph. That's what he had in that movie. They all had triumphs. And wasn't a Harley to be seen. And And then I transferred to NYU. So NYU is in the village. I really didn't know, you know, I grew up in Queens, but I was just a kid. My mother took me to the opera. She took me to see ballet and things like that. But I mean, I didn't know. I don't think she knew where Greenwich. Well, maybe she did. Her dentist was in Greenwich Village. But it was just pure serendipity that I transferred in 1961 or two to NYU, which is right on the square. And I could see the fountain out the window of my classes and see them, especially in the afternoon, see that the music starting to happen and people playing guitars. And so after a year of school, I quit. And then I spent a year playing in the basket houses in Greenwich Village. And I was on a rent strike. It was the only way I could afford, you know, so I could live on $10 a day and feed myself. So if that's all I made, that was fine. And someone came and saw me and sent me to Bobby Scott, a marvelous jazz pianist who was working for Bobby Darin at that point. And he loved me and just thought, he says, "You're so ignorant. It's just marvelous." And of course I was. I mean, I played by myself. I learned to play by ear. I mean, last time I read music, I was 10. I think, and I had been playing no gigs really until I started playing the basket houses, and then that was my complete experience. But somehow, halfway through that year, he took me into the studio and said, "Okay, kid, sit over there and play everything you know." And 4 hours later, I had an album called Soul of a City Boy. And he had picked the tunes as I went through, and he had arranged them in order, and it was done. I mean, when we walked out of there, I had a copy of Soul of a City Boy. Actually, they didn't give me a copy. He had a copy. So that when it came out, I went right to work in the folk houses, and mostly in Boston, like the Club 47. And the first song on the album is 4 in the Morning. And there was a DJ in Boston on an AM station, rock station, that started, he was on at like 10 o'clock at night. He started playing folk music, kind of, because Boston was the center of the folk revolution as far as venues. They must have been in the Boston area. There must have been 30 clubs. You know, there were only 3 in Manhattan that were. So I was up there a lot, and I met Jerry Corbett up there. He sent me a little note at my sound check once that said, "Don't go home." And he said, "Don't go home, go to my place." And I guess the place I was staying, that guy was being arrested for selling pot to the Coast Guard undercover. And I ended up at Corbett's house. And then I started always staying with him. And we just started playing on the porch. And he started showing up at my gigs, beautiful harmonica player. And that lovely baritone voice that you hear on Get Together underneath mine. And it just happened. And, you know, after a year of that and me teaching him, my whole, all the songs that I was playing at that point, we kind of looked at each other one day and said, I think we ought to get an amplifier. Now this is, and a couple of pickups. I think it's time for us to have a band. I mean, the Beatles were very inspiring. A band that was not just writing silly songs about what we all knew about. And then we couldn't find a bass player, and McCartney, of course, for me was he's doing it. It must be able to be done. I'm going to play bass. Because we had three guitar players and a drummer and no bass player, and we couldn't find one. So I went.
You picked it up.
Yes. And so it was doubly exciting for me. The first, year or two of the Youngbloods, I'm learning a new instrument and also learning how to use monitors and hear myself with a whole lot of, because I was playing solo until Corbett. And then we, played duo for a while, but that was.
So at that point, you were officially the Youngbloods. That's your name, and you're calling yourself that, and you're playing around Boston.
Mostly Greenwich Village.
Village, okay.
We spent almost a year at the Cafe Agogo, and we would open for whomever, whether it was Muddy Waters or Ian and Sylvia, who were headlining. They'd stick us in there and give us each $20. So that, luckily, an apartment was $70 a month on the Lower East Side. So we were able to do it. And then our manager started bringing, record company people down. And we started out as Jesse Colin Young and the Lonely Knights or the Jerry Corbett Three or the, I forget, there were a couple other names that went through there. And then finally we settled on Youngbloods and RCA came along and gave us the right, which was difficult to do in those days, to choose our own producer. And because we wanted Felix Pappalardi, and he was not an establishment figure at that point, just a brilliant musician and a good friend. And so they said, okay, and that was it. And so there we are. We've got the record deal. We've got the producer we wanted. And we started recording.
So what year did you put out your first album?
I'm trying to think. 66, I think. Grizzly Bear was released. I don't know whether they released the album first or just Grizzly Bear, because my daughter Julie was born in 66. That's why I know. And we called her Julie Bear because Grizzly Bear was on the radio. So, that fall, we must have released, because usually they released the album in those days and then singles on top of that.
Was Get Together on that first album?
It is. And that's when they released Get Together after Grizzly Bear as a single. And that's when it was a hit in San Francisco and the North Coast. And that's what took us out of New York to Point Reyes, California, and building studios. And
what was that experience like when you put out an album and you're sort of yanked out of, not obscurity, but in a sense obscurity, there's a handful of people who know who you are, and then you have this song that goes viral, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And when you were living through that experience, was it exciting? Was it pressure filled because you have one hit, now you got to keep writing and coming up with new hits? How does that work?
Well, it worked differently for us because Get Together was a hit twice. In 67, it was a North Coast hit. And, instead of 40 or 100 people we were drawing in New York. I mean, we could fill the Avalon Ballroom. And we had, because it was the summer of love and Get Together was just the natural theme song. So that's why it was all over the radio. And it was happening. And so that for a long time, we played between there and New England colleges and the West Coast. That's mostly where we played for the, and then in 69 in June, Augie Bloom, who was the head of promotion at RCA, said, we have to release Get Together again. I think he said, now is the time. The rest of the country has kind of come around. And I think he could smell Woodstock Nation coming. But what an instinct. And he forced them. He threatened to quit. And they would have been fools to let Augie was the best in the business. So he said, we're putting this out. But we don't do that, Augie. Said, yes, we do. Because it is time. And of course, he was right. It was time. So then Get Together was a national hit, and we started playing, you know, all over the country instead of just on the coast.
Were you at Woodstock or?
No, what a mistake. I don't know. We were at one of Bill Graham's booked in one of his venues that weekend. I can't remember the name of it, and it wasn't. And I wish, I don't know what happened. I don't know, it would have been just perfect for us, but we missed it. But the music was there. I think Richie Havens probably sang it. He was there. And he had been there in the go-go with us coming along, when we were just breaking out and he was breaking out.
Well, it was such an iconic hit. Record, it sort of symbolized everything that was going on at that time in the late 60s. And like you said, everyone, you know, coming together. And after that period, you sort of embarked on a solo career. And when was that in the 70s, sort of mm-hmm. right after this?
Probably 72. Yeah. Corbett left the Youngbloods in the middle of Elephant Mountain.
Is that the album that had Darkness, Darkness on it?
Yes.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so we ended up being a trio for almost all of that album. I think Corbett played on a couple songs, never did any vocals. So, and he left to go form a band with Charlie Daniels, which they did. But we completed that album as a trio and played like that for a while, for a couple of years, and then it just wore thin for me. I was ready. I don't know. I was listening to the band. I was listening to music from Big Pink. I was listening to Taj Mahal. I wanted something funkier, especially as a bass player. And I think it was time for me to go back to guitar. So I let go. I said, Youngbloods is over, guys. I'm sorry. I can't do it anymore. But we had, you know, we had Raccoon Records. Warner Brothers gave us a label, and I was able to make a solo album, an acoustic album, and that was part of my learning that I was ready to get on with something new. And but all the guys did. Joe, our drummer, he recorded his favorite jazz people, and Banana recorded a bluegrass group called High Country. That so it was time. It was time for me to move on.
So, as a solo artist, did that enable you to musically explore some things that maybe would have been harder to explore as a member of a band? For example, I know that there are a number of social and environmental causes that are near and dear to your heart. And mm-hmm. maybe as a solo artist, you could just explore those topics more easily?
I was meant to be a solo artist because I like being the boss. I was talked into giving that up in the Youngbloods, and it was, well, it couldn't have been a mistake, but I mean, it was not easy for me because I was used to kind of leading the charge and figuring out things. And Corbett and I were kind of on the same page, but Joe and Banana were on a different trip. And so there was always tension there. Then when Corbett left, I was in a band with guys that I was not terribly close to personally, which was a little peculiar. I mean, we could play together, and some of the stuff we did as a trio early on was pretty, it amazed me, but I outgrew it pretty fast. You know, I missed the a lot of my best friends in my life have been the people in my bands, and we've shared all that stuff that you go through to come together, to make it work, to make a living at it, to get what you need from it. All of those things make pretty strong friendships, or have for me. And but I really like, I like being the boss, and that worked better. And it worked for a while. That was a wonderful band that I kind of call it the Song for Julie band, because that's the first record we released after the Youngbloods. I just kind of went in and I had learned how to operate my studio. I had to, first I had to learn how to build it and engineer the walls. And I said, really, you can't make the walls parallel? And no. And you, angles are everything, because you don't want sound bouncing back and forth between, in a box, because it creates standing waves and trouble. So
I had a lot. And you were raising a family during this time period?
Yeah. Julie was born in 66, and Cheyenne in 70. Yep. And building a house. And, or not me. No, I'm. I was part of it. It was wonderful. When they first put up the floor, there were no walls. The floor, and the way we were such a, on a steep slope that just the floor of the house in the front was, you know, it looked like it ran all the way to Tamales Bay. It was, that was a beautiful experience to watch it go up. And kind of saying, God, I wish we didn't have to put walls. Yeah.
Could you see the water from your house?
Yeah, but we're not looking at the ocean. We're looking east at this long, skinny bay, which is shaped like a tamale. So Tamales Bay, that's all the names there. I mean, all of that was part of Mexico or Spain. But it's beautiful. And this mountain called Elephant Mountain, which we saw, so I'm looking across this beautiful little bay at Elephant Mountain, which kind of looks like it. I guess if you're high enough, it looks like an elephant lying on its side.
Was that your favorite place to write music?
Yes. At home. I mean, for me, living there in the woods was, you know, my parents sent me to camp in the Adirondack Mountains when I was at probably 8 or 9. They had to get rid of me in the summer. I get, I, you know, I understand having raised four children. But I think I dreamed about living in the forest from those 2 or 3 years in the Adirondack Mountains and swimming in that lake. I've been dreaming about ridgetops since that time, and never really realized it until Youngbloods. We just moved out to the country from the Lower East Side, and that was a big leap for us, but we thought, well, we can do this. We're self-contained. We don't, and it's an hour and a half to the city, and we can work.
So as a songwriter, I know that in 2002, I believe, Robert Plant covered Darkness, Darkness. Actually, a lot of artists, I think, have covered that song, but he was up for a Grammy nomination for that song. How does it feel as a songwriter to see someone else performing your work and maybe taking it in a different direction?
Oh, it was lovely. He called me. I don't know how he got my number. I was living in Hawaii, because that's where we ended up in 95 when the house burned down on the ridgetop in this little house. And then we made it a little bigger because there were four of us, not two of us. He said he was in the back of a taxi, and it was midnight or something. I think it's almost 12 hours, 11 or 12, you know, Hawaii to London. And he said, I'm recording Darkness, Darkness, and I want you to hear what I'm doing. And so I gave him my address, and I don't think we were sending music over the internet yet, or I wasn't anyway. So it was wonderful. He sent me five different, they were doing different mixes for all different kinds of radio. And I loved what he did to Darkness. And he did, he got a Grammy.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool version of the song. And so let's sort of move into modern day era. Mm-hmm. You quit playing music for a bit, and more recently decided to get back at it again. So why did you walk away for just a bit?
Lyme disease. Yeah. Took me out. Seriously, but I spent years walking through those woods in West Marin. When I first moved out there, there was a guy between me and the ocean. There was a guy who ran a few cows in that, you know, hundreds or thousands of acres or whatever. And I only met him once, but I could walk through those woods blazing my own trails and never see a soul, but see herds of white deer. Somebody had, you know, 30 or 40 years before that had brought deer from Bavaria or somewhere, right? These beautiful white deer. And they, you know, there were hundreds of them in the park. And seals on the beach at the end of Limantur Spit. I was there when I could actually ride my dirt bike out onto the beach and get on the hard part of the sand, which was, you know, if the tide was going out, and ride out to the end of the spit. I remember the first time I did it, and the seals, I had no idea there'd be a bunch of, you know, there were 50 seals out there sunning themselves at the end of the spit, and they jumped in the water, but they only went out about 10 feet, and then they all poked their heads up and said, what is this thing? It doesn't smell like a man. It doesn't look like a man. You know, I had a helmet on. They didn't run away. They just kind of, to come out of the Lower East Side and to have that kind of experiences with wildlife for me was just ecstatic. I feel like I'd gone to heaven.
Did you actually get out on the water? Were you into boating or?
No, I didn't. No, boats and I don't get along. Under the water, I'm fine. I did become a scuba diver, but did most of my diving in Hawaii because it's awfully cold. That I wasn't used to the, you know, the Pacific Ocean is cold, and you know, Jones Beach is, the water's warm in the summer, so I never got used to the cold water. Although, but I did get in it occasionally. And when I did, I was all alone down there on that beach. Unbelievable for a New Yorker like me to find himself looking way, way down the beach, a half mile away. There's one other person, and thinking, how can this be? So along with all those blessings and that heaven came, tick bites, and nobody was, this was before Lyme disease was named, before some guy named Bergdorf discovered or isolated the, you know, it's been so long, I forget, there's some little critter that carries the Lyme disease, I mean, in your blood. The ticks injected, but so it caught up with me, and just, you know, for 5 or 6 or 7 years, I struggled with it. And beyond that, I mean, I'd had it probably for, since, you know, the late 60s. And I think when the house burned down, the trauma of that, I was so connected to that land, the land I wrote that Ridgetop about, and it was traumatic. And we moved to Hawaii after that because, you know, we had a spare house. We were lucky, and I had always wanted to live in the islands. And but Lyme disease said, "Oh, now's the time. He's, you know, he's down." So it really, it reared its head. And of course, nobody knew what it was. Nobody was, no doctor that I went to was even testing for it. So I just thought I was, you know, I was having PTSD from the, and tried to work my way through it. But it was tough. But that's over.
But you're back.
Yeah, I'm back. Thanks to my marvelous Dr. Richard Horowitz. One of his protocols, his wife. You know, for a while, people with what we call chronic Lyme, the AMA was denying that there was such a thing. He said, "No, you get Lyme disease, you take doxycycline for 3 weeks, it's done." Yeah, well, those of us who had taken doxycycline for 3 years and knew that it didn't just go away. And his wife had the same, Richard's wife had the same disease, and he kept experimenting with different protocols. And 2 or 3 years ago, I came off the road, and because I knew it, and tried this 6-week protocol of 6 different drugs at the same time, and it's gone.
Amazing.
Yeah. Oh God. You know, and I have my life back.
Well, and I know that last year, 2021, was there was a big anniversary hour. You were playing. I saw a tape of you online playing Get Together with Steve Miller.
Yeah, Steve Miller. Yeah, I wanted to make a new version of it. I had recorded. So I started to get better in like 2016 or 15. because Richard was treating me for years and years to some effect, but it kept coming back. So Connie and I started writing, and I hadn't written, I hadn't written a song for 5 years. And our son was at Berklee College of Music, Tristan, and I went to his senior recital, and it just blew me away. I ran backstage afterwards and said, "Gee, I want a band like this." He said, "Come on, Dad, you're not ready for this. You know what it's like. It's way too much work." I said, "T, I'm getting better. I want it." It's, and so after he finally agreed to help me put a band together, I mean, because these were all his, and the band ended up being all his friends and acquaintances from Berklee, all of them in their 20s, and all of them marvelous young geniuses. Wow. We made a record together called Dreamers. I think that came out in 18, because I think I played 3 or 4 gigs with them. I thought it was going to be just a quick go to South By, get ready, go to South By, and then it'd be over. And no, after playing those warm-up gigs with them, I said, "I want to record with these youngsters." And we did in Nashville.
It sounds like playing with your son was inspiring.
It was, and all of them. So, so young and so, so good. But, I mean, and yeah, their energy, it was amazing. It was a beautiful time.
Yeah. And your daughter is a musician as well, Jazzy. You said earlier that she put out an album and...
Yes.
And a single that y'all just released, Trouble.
Yes. And Jazzy's been writing songs since she was, 11 or 12. And I remember my son Cheyenne said to me once when he was visiting, and she didn't play for anybody very much, but occasionally she'd play for the family or she'd write a new song and she'd play for Connie and I. And I think Cheyenne heard one of them, Dad. He said, "Dad, is there somebody, some kid that I should beat up?" Because the songs were so sophisticated, relationship songs, deep. And, you know, she was 12. So, yeah. And so last year she released her first EP, Grown Up and Grown Apart. Beautiful songs, all of them. And when I used to take her to school in Hawaii when she was in grade school, she was a wonderful, beautiful singer. Her voice, very strong. And but I used to, I used to sing Trouble a lot. I think I was having trouble with Lyme disease, so it became my theme song to myself. And so Jazzy always thought it was my song because I would sing it in the truck or I would play a tape of me singing it when I was trying to record it. And so last summer, I decided to record it again. And I asked Jazzy if she would sing, because we had yet to really record our voices together. So she said yes. And then we did a little animation along with the video. And I didn't know anything about that. So they had discovered Barb Hoffman, and I did the music part, and then Jazzy did her parts. We're on different coasts, and then Barb kind of put them together, and Jazzy, it's wonderful. I love the way she just kind of appears and sings, sometimes two of her.
And Trouble is the song by Cat Stevens, right?
Yes.
Beautiful song,
I've loved it. yeah, half of my life. And yeah, to be able to make a song, be able to do it with my daughter, who I think is a, she is a full-blown singer-songwriter of her generation. She's is an amazing artist. And yeah, so there we are together doing this song that kind of from her childhood and that got me through a lot of bumpy places.
Well, before we go, I have one last question for you, Jesse. If you could kind of sum up what music, the thread of music and being a musician has meant to you through everything that you've gone through, what has that really meant to you?
Well, it's, you know, I really feel like it's what I came here to do. I found my calling. And all my test scores, and I always had high math scores, but I guess a lot of musicians are good at math, but it comes to, you know, they always said I should be an engineer or something. And I, you know, and my dad went to Harvard and all this, and then my uncle spent his life at Yale teaching, and my dad put him through college. He went, they were 6 years apart. And so there was a lot of, and I didn't, you know, for me to do this, to just kind of jump into this without really, and just do it. I think when I was about 40, my dad said to me, you know, son, you got a lot of guts. I would have never gone into life without a degree, without some kind of path that was laid, the way you jumped into music and made it happen. And yeah, I think every man dreams about hearing his father say something like that to him, like, wow, son, you done good. It's wonderful. And
well, the world is a better place because you were musically in it. So.
Oh, thank you. It has been my great pleasure and honor to, I mean, to go into the stay at home here in South Carolina. And sitting with Connie and trying to figure out, okay, I guess we're not going out to dinner. What are we going to do? And Connie said, go get your guitar. Come on, I'll get my phone. We'll do a phone video. We'll play Sugar Babe or something like that. Which, because people are feeling weird. We feel weird. There's a lot of people out there who are feeling just as weird as we do. And maybe we can help. So we did that for 3 or 4 months through that year, that first year of COVID. And I ended up making a solo album, which I hadn't done since Sullivan City Boy. And actually, I'm going back to work next week on volume 2 of Highway Troubadour, which is will be more solo stuff.
But when that comes out, definitely let us know.
Oh, I will. I will.
Well, and thank you so much for taking this time to talk to us. It's been amazing hearing about your life, and we wish you the best, and come see us in Memphis sometime.
I will. We're going to come to Memphis when this, it gets a little less hairy. There's some things I want to do. I might even go to Graceland. I mean, I loved Elvis.
Well, come on down, as they say in the South.
All right. Thank you so much for your interest.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. You have a great rest of your week.
It's been so great having Jesse Colin Young on the show today. Founder of the Young Bloods and part of a generation inspired by Jack Kerouac's On the Road and Marlon Brando's The Wild One, Young most recently recorded a new version of the Young Bloods hit Get Together in 2021 with Steve Miller. And he's also playing and recording new music with his two kids, Tristan and Jazzy. You can learn more about what he's up to by visiting jessecolinyoung.com. From all of us at Diddy TV, thanks for tuning in today, and we hope you'll join us again soon, right here on Insights.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.